Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome everyone here in the room and those online to this event, which marks the launch of the Grantham Research Institute 2024 Trends in Climate Change Litigation Policy Report, produced in partnership with the Sabine Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. This session is being held as part of the London Climate Week and of its flagship event series. I hope many of you have had a chance to attend other events during the week. My name is Carmen Nuzzo. I am professor in practice and the executive director of the Transition Pathway Initiative Center, or TPI Center for short, and I will be the chair of today's session. The TPI Center is part of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. It is an independent and rigorous source of research and data into the progress which corporates and sovereigns are making in the transition to a low carbon economy. And if you have not heard about our work, I would really encourage you to take a look at our website, www.transitionpathwayinitiative.org. So the climate change litigation report has become a much awaited event, an annual document, and it's now the sixth of a series that speaks not just to lawyers and general counsels, but also to investors, corporates, sovereigns, and anyone really interested in climate change. So the plan for the session is the following. We will begin with a short presentation by the authors of the report. Joanna Setzer is here, Associate Professor, Research Fellow at the Grantham Research Institute. She leads on the Climate Change Laws of the World project. And Catherine Higham is Policy Fellow at the Grantham and she coordinates the Climate Change Laws of the World project as well. We will then hear reflections and have a discussion with our esteemed panelists. I will introduce them now very briefly, but I've asked them to say a little bit about their role and the very unique perspectives that they bring to the panel tonight. So starting from the left of Kate Harrow, Professor Harrow van Asselt, who is Hatton Professor of Climate Law at the University of Cambridge and Law Fellow Hugh Hall. He's also Professor of Climate Law and Policy at the University of Eastern Finland Law School and an affiliated researcher within the Stockholm Environment Institute. Next to him, we have Janita Sedilikova, who is Director of Climate and Biodiversity Risk at the consultancy, firm Planet Law Lab and a Biodiversity Risk Advisor at the Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative, where she carries out research and provides strategic biodiversity loss can pose a material risk to financial institutions and corporations. And last but not least, we have Cynthia Hannawald, who is joining us online today. She's the director of the Sabine Center's Financial Regulation Practice. Her work supports regulatory and policy responses to climate-related financial risk at the federal and state level and includes a focus on the complex intersections of ESG and antitrust law with sustainability goals and climate resiliency measures. We have allowed plenty of room for those of you who are here and those online to ask questions after the initial panel discussion. And a final reminder that this event is being recorded. Technology doesn't fail us. And the recording will be available in the next few days online. And finally, please do not forget to switch off your phones and don't look at them and listen to the panel. And for those of you who are here in person, there will be also a drinks reception at the Pear Tree Cafe at Lincoln Innsfield. There will be stewards that will be guiding you in the right direction. So without further ado, back to the report. The new 2024 snapshot on global climate change litigation found that the pace of growth of the new climate cases may be starting to stabilize compared to the rapid rise that we've seen in recent years. However, litigants continue to develop new types of cases and legal arguments, and we continue to see significant geographical diversity. So we look forward to hearing more about what are these new cases and where they're from. And the floor is over to you, Joanna. Thank you.
Thank you, Carmen. Okay. Thank you, Carmen, and good evening, everyone. Welcome to the LSE. Thank you for joining us tonight for this, I think we can call it a tradition. It's the sixth report in global trends in climate litigation. So very happy to be again here. The world of litigation keeps changing. We still have a lot to say and get through. So first, before we go into the presentation, I wanted to have a first round of thank yous because this report is very much a labor of love. It involves many colleagues, some here and some many who are not here today, but I wanted to make this time to thank them. So first, our colleagues at the Sabin Center at Columbia University, particularly Maria Antonia Cigri and Margaret Barry, who put a lot of work in collecting the data. Many colleagues at GRI, at the Grantham Research Institute, are involved in several moments of this process. We want to thank particularly Emily Bredin, who spends a lot of time classifying, coding, crunching numbers, but many other colleagues also involved. Then, thanks to the reviewers, we do this report in a very thorough academic way, and it actually gets many more reviews than most papers would by people who actually know what they're doing. Harrow was one of our reviewers. Many others have been tough reviewers, and we take all their comments into consideration. We address all of them, and what is there is really responding to their views, but of course, all errors are our own. And finally, of course, thanks to the panelists, thanks to our chair, Carmen Uzu, who I think until recently didn't know much about litigation, and now every other day sends me news about the new case that she read about. So we'd love to convert people into realizing how climate litigation is exciting and important. And finally, thanks to all of you who came. There's so many events. It's sunny outside, but hopefully after the event, we can head to the cafe here at the park and have a chat, thanks to the online audience as well. Okay, enough of thank yous. Let's crack on. Kate and I will share these next 12 minutes between us. I will begin by giving this overview of the report, and Kate will then go and discuss some of the most important findings. But there's much, much more there in the report, so of course you have to read. Let's begin with the map. So every year we have this map, and Kate, we did that, what's the name, slow motion?
You're asking hard questions now, Joanna.
The thing that shows time lapse of every year how the map is changing. So the time lapse shows this increase in darker colors and spread around the world. We continue to see this spread around the world. So that is clear here. But also, we see some interesting trends in terms of where this is growing. So in terms of where countries, we now know there's litigation in at least 55 countries around the world, and this is based primarily on the data compiled by the Sabin Center. Now, new countries entered the Hall of Fame this year. We have Panama and Portugal for the first time with climate cases. We also identified Hungary and Namibia, where cases had been filed in previous years, but identified now. And the pizza chart there shows also the divide between North, South, and international. So in terms of Global South, we have identified over 200 cases now in the Global South, which tells us that this phenomenon that started as a US northern phenomenon has now become also more distributed, with Brazil leading the way in developing countries with the majority of cases of Global South. Now, in relation to the international cases, we have seen that these, although respond for a small 5% of the total, they have raised quite a lot of attention in this previous year. We have seen a month ago, in May, the first advisory opinion issued by the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea, ITLOS. This was the first time that an international court answered to the important question, do states, do countries have an obligation to protect the climate? And the answer that ITLOS gave was yes, countries have that obligation. And it stated that greenhouse gas emissions can be understood as a source of marine pollution, that states have obligations to prevent such pollution and to restore damaged ocean ecosystems. I wanted also to mention that we had an interesting, important landmark decision in India by the Supreme Court of India confirming a new constitutional right, that is the right for people to be free from the adverse effects of climate change. Now, this graph, we have this graph every year, and people seem to look, and of course we see that since the Paris Agreement, that's been a sharp increase, and then you look at what's happening, and there's this question, is the rate of growth slowing? So we saw climate mitigation is spreading, but what we can say in terms of growth is that yes, there is still a growth. We identified in this last year 230 new cases in 2023, taking us to a total of over 2,600 cases in total around the globe, US and non-US. Now, the question of whether there is a slowdown, I think we can't answer. We still don't know. What we can see is that there's maybe a drop, but there are a few reasons that might explain. So first, we have to keep in mind that there's an issue of data collection. The more cases, the more spread out in the world, is harder to keep track. And we have limited resources for doing that. And maybe also we could be seeing some sort of stabilization or consolidation phase where quality matters more than quantity, where maybe lawyers are waiting for decisions in important cases before they file new ones. And also the fact that in many jurisdictions, litigation tends to respond or fluctuate depending on political and the regulatory climate of countries. So I have now one last point before I hand it over to Kate, which is something we emphasize in this new report, which is this issue that not all climate litigation might be aligned with climate goals. Throughout the history of climate litigation, there's been a tendency, and we have this tendency to look at the climate-aligned cases, the cases that are pushing for more action. But there's always been this two sides of the story. Of course, litigation can be brought by several actors. So this last year, non-aligned cases have gained some prominence, and we, for the first time, spend more time examining these. So we've examined around 50 non-aligned cases. One of the prominent examples, I will only mention this one here, illustrated by these FT and Bloomberg headlines, is a suit brought by Exxon against a shareholder activist group, two actually, Arjuna Capitals and Follow This in the US. And these groups were they had filed a shareholder resolution urging Exxon to adopt more rapid emissions reductions trajectory. So what happens is that Exxon then files a case against these groups, and they pulled out their resolution. So the case was dismissed because of that, ultimately, but it could indicate that companies are also using strategic litigation to threaten or to increase the risk for those who are trying to use it in a more activist way. So I don't want to make you feel too concerned about this whole litigation movement going turning a bit bitter. So I'll pass to Kate, and she will discuss more of the aligned cases, and so the ones that are seeking action and ambition from governments and corporations.
Thank you, Joanna, and thank you all for being here today. As Joanna says, this report is really a labour of love, so it's great to see how many people are here to talk about it, and we're looking forward to hearing all of your thoughts in the Q&A session. As Joanna said, my job is a little bit more heartening than hers has been. I'm going to talk about some of the trends in cases that are seeking and in many circumstances actually gaining support for more climate action from governments and companies. I'm going to start with cases against governments. Historically, the majority of climate change litigation has been against government actors. No surprise when you consider that governments are the people with primary responsibility for addressing this challenge. But what we've seen in the last year is some major successes in this type of cases. You can see the picture on the slide, the Klima Seniorinnen, the Swiss senior women. They started a case in 2016 arguing that the Swiss government wasn't doing enough to protect their rights from the impacts of climate change. And just this year, they finally convinced a court to agree with them. It was the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, which has found for the first time ever that the European Convention on Human Rights imposes obligations on governments to introduce stringent climate change legislation and policy to protect the rights of citizens. Now, historically, this type of case, which we call government framework cases, has actually met with more failures than they have met with successes, although there have been some landmarks along the way. And we think that this case could be something of a turning point, particularly here in Europe, where we see more and more of these cases being successful in the near future. It's not the only success we've seen. We also had a very significant case in Belgium that was heard at the end of last year. And the first US case led by youth climate litigants to achieve success in the state of Montana, based on Montana's state constitutional law. So significant movement in this idea about governments owing obligations to protect their citizens. But perhaps the bigger story of recent years is that climate change litigation is really starting to target corporations as well. And one of the big things that we see is that not only are there more cases being filed against companies, you can see the real growth since 2020. It's pretty significant. But we're also seeing an increasing diversity. And that diversity is in both the types of cases that are being filed and in terms of the types of companies that are being targeted. You can see this very broad list of sectors that have been involved in climate cases in the last few years. When people think about climate change litigation against corporations, if they think about it at all, they tend to think about cases where someone is suing a major emitter, like a fossil fuel company, for causing the climate impacts that they are suffering from. And we do see about 30 of these cases that have been filed since 2015, the year of the Paris Agreement, including one filed by a Belgian farmer against the French energy company Total earlier this year. But that's only 30 of these cases. Actually, the main driver of this kind of litigation at the moment is what we call climate washing cases. So these are cases which are challenging a disconnect between what companies say they're doing on climate change and what they are actually doing in terms of their operations. And this is an area where we've seen huge growth in the last few years. There are now more than 140 of these cases that we know about, and of course, we don't know about every case in the world. And so far, they've had about a 70% success rate. So this is a serious phenomenon to watch. But we're also seeing important other developments in the field of corporate climate litigation, including the development of cases that are looking at how you manage climate change transition risk, often disputes between shareholders and the directors and officers of companies. And while there aren't very many of these cases at the moment, it's a very important area to watch for the future. If you're interested in understanding transition risk and how litigation could amplify that, I do recommend you read that part of the report. So we've told you that this is a phenomenon that's growing and spreading, and there's lots of different types of cases. But one of the things that we try and do in the report, in the final section, is to help you to understand what all of that actually means in the real world. We look at how various different stakeholder groups are responding to this phenomenon of climate change litigation. We look at legislators that are starting to incorporate some of the ideas in climate cases into legislation. There's some important developments at the state level in the US, for example. But we also look at how other stakeholders are responding. And I wanted to show just one of those, which is the response that we've seen from central bankers and regulators, and to think a bit about how that's evolved in recent years. In 2015, Mark Carney gave a now famous speech calling climate change litigation a tragedy of the horizon. He was at the time the governor of the Bank of England, and he predicted that this tragedy of the horizon would lead to significant liability risk, as well as many other risks. If we fast forward nearly 10 years, we have Frank Elderson, another central banker from the European Central Bank, who has said we have actually arrived at that horizon that Carney predicted. This is now a phenomenon that, in his view, regulators and financial institutions really need to be taking seriously. And there is a lot of work that's going on to try and think about how do we understand and mitigate these types of risks. So it's just one of the ways in which this is influencing the kind of governance of climate change more broadly. So thank you so much. You can download the reports using this QR code that I was very proud of myself for creating earlier today. If you haven't already read it, and we're very much looking forward to the responses of our panelists who will talk about some of the more specific aspects of the report. Thank you.
Joanna, thank you, Kate. I think your enthusiasm is really infective and contagious, so it's great. And just seeing the sheer volume of the increase despite the recent slow that we've seen, but the diversity, how it's spreading across regions and types of cases is very illuminating. I wanted to pick Kate, on one of your last comments to discuss with the panel, this idea you've highlighted, and rightly so, all the successful cases that we've seen recently. But one of the things that struck me in the report when I read it is that also the cases that fail, where plaintiffs do not manage to win, actually do have repercussions and ripple effects that could have consequences for policy or future legislation. So I wonder if the panel could start discussing this a little bit. Perhaps maybe we can begin with Cynthia, who's been patiently waiting online.
I'm happy to join in. Thank you for having me. I do want to say I think this report is a phenomenal resource. So many of us work in our own little corner of climate change law, and I think we really benefit from the immense effort reflected here to digest what's happening across the field. So I'm very grateful for that work. I'm delighted to offer a few reactions, but maybe I'll hold those and just go to your question now, which is related to, I think, this challenge of non-climate aligned litigation in particular that was mentioned earlier, and sort of what are the potential unintended consequences there, or ways in which the courts are sort of learning how to grapple with climate change. And the antitrust example is perhaps a good one, where you can see that competition laws have been mobilized, particularly in the US, to think about ways in which conservative politicians and the fossil fuel industries are pushing back on climate action. And that behavior has often been typical collaborative behaviors like standard setting, and then suddenly it appears in the climate context, and net zero examples for in particular come to mind, and then they are challenged under laws that have never been used in this way. So I think we are seeing many other types of laws get pulled into this as we're dealing with the sort of unintended consequences question.
Great. Thank you. Sarah,
perhaps. Right. So I guess first of all, also on my behalf, congratulations to Joanna, Kate, and the broader Grantham Research Institute team on another, yet another excellent, timely and important report. So from my perspective, and maybe just very briefly on the types of cases that are under scrutinized, but I do think also the report, not just this year, but also in the past year, has already been highlighting them. I think one particular types of cases that I would also emphasize there are the investment arbitration cases that have arisen in the past few years. And I expect this to be an ongoing trend, because as long as countries are phasing out fossil fuels in the coming years, there will be investors who have put a lot of money into that, who see that their investments will be at risk. And I expect there will be also an ongoing trend. We have a number of cases that have been withdrawn or settled out of court, and I would say there's some adjacent cases that have been going to a ruling, but I expect in the coming years that this will really come to a head. And I think it's important to also realize that this is also part of the broader picture of climate litigation, and that ultimately we need to not just think of all of the cases as something that will produce a beneficial outcome for the climate, but also some cases might actually pose certain risks.
Thank you, Hara. Huge amount of assets that need to be unwound that investors have vested interest in that need to be adequately priced. Janita, you bring a different perspective to the panel, because most of the focus of your work, in addition to climate per se, is also on biodiversity. And we've seen in the report that the number of cases related to deforestation and biodiversity is also increasing. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so I was thinking how to bring the biodiversity liability in the 5 minutes. So I want to give you an example of one strand of cases which is very readily to be just lifted and shifted from climate to biodiversity. And then one example of a type of cases which are very different in between climate and biodiversity, but actually easier to establish in biodiversity, and when you take biodiversity loss as a core issue. So the report called them climate washing cases, but I'll call them greenwashing, because climate washing obviously concerns climate statements like net zero or climate neutral cases. And Kay told us that the rate of success of these cases is 70%. Which is very high, given the uncertainties of litigation. Now, climate washing cases or greenwashing cases, if you just change the statements from net zero to nature positive or carbon neutrality to restoration, that the legal framework around the case doesn't change. The messaging changes from, and you can change it even to plastic or water risk. A company can say we are reducing our water pollution. The content of the statement is agnostic as to the litigation framework and the legal framework around it. So greenwashing cases are one of the strand of cases that are very ready to be just lifted and shifted and implement in biodiversity against biodiversity commitments that are inaccurate or misleading as such. So from the perspective of governments and also corporates, the more statements on nature positive impacts or reducing deforestation we see, the more likely we are going to see uptake in greenwashing cases. And I suspect it will be much faster than climate, because there is already the climate precedence. So that is the type of cases that are very readily to be lifted and shifted. The cases which are very, very different when you compare climate and biodiversity are the damages-based cases. So most panelists today know much better than I do that in climate litigation, damages-based cases, we have one big in Germany, which is the Luja case, RWE, where a Peruvian farmer is suing German utility company for damage that is being caused by greenhouse gases to glaciers that are melting near his home and near his community that are endangering the survival of that community. And these cases struggle in courts. Luja case was filed in 2015, and we still don't have a decision almost 10 years later. And the struggle concerns causation, so the legal in English law, it could be but for test, it could be material contribution test. We have other theories. If you're interested, I'm very happy to talk about them in more detail. But the attribution question is really difficult because what the claimants have to do, they have to prove to the court that emissions generated in Germany somehow caused the melting of glaciers in Peru. And that's quite a remote causation test. So scientists are helping us, are helping the litigants by coming up with different attribution theories. That's the issue of climate change because it's global. Biodiversity loss is a localized problem. Biodiversity loss is always local. And that actually removes the causation issue of attribution. What we see in biodiversity cases is that causation is established by three means so far. We have had causation established through tracing supply chains, or tracing money, or tracing ownership structures. So tracing of supply chains means you trace a commodity. So beef or soy, you trace it from a country where it is produced, somewhere in the global south, usually Latin America, and you trace it to the supermarket in France, and you sue that supermarket, and there is a case like that in France. Ownership structure, essentially what you are doing, you are tracing negative impacts caused by a subsidiary in the global south to its parent in the global north, and there is a case like that, Mariana case, before UK courts. And the tracing of money is a very novel methodology. The first case was filed in December last year in France against four banks, and the argument there is by holding bonds in companies that engage in illegal deforestation, these banks are actually engaging in money laundering. So the basis of these cases is money laundering. The whole point is the causation issue, which we see in climate cases, which surrounds the question of attribution, is completely removed by tracing supply chains, ownership structures, or money. So to sum up, we have greenwashing cases which in climate, when they surround climate, they have the highest rate of success. And those could be readily lifted and shifted to biodiversity. We have damages-based cases which struggle with climate, but are much easier with biodiversity. And the sum up of this, you don't have to be a scientist or a panelist to know, it's probably that biodiversity litigation is going to fast track climate litigation.
Maybe because it's easier to identify and quantify as opposed to the global.
There are some issues there, but I think it's so local that it's much easier. Yeah, it's just almost that
contain it.
In the global north, yeah. Which is where the litigants want to see you.
I wonder, before we open the floor to the question to the floor, if Haro and Cynthia have any other concrete cases like the ones that Trinita just mentioned that really show impact.
That really show an impact. Well, so I think that raises the broader question, right, like of what we actually refer to as an impact of climate litigation. And of course, the report talks about that as well, right? Like, so the report distinguishes between direct and indirect impacts, with the direct impact being a positive ruling, right? Like, so the plaintiffs got what they wanted, they get certain types of remedies. But it's the indirect impacts that I think most people are actually interested in. And here I think there's a number of different variety of impacts that we need to consider. Right? Like ultimately, we might want to look at the greenhouse gas emission reductions or avoided emissions achieved. Or we might want to see the resilience built in particular communities or actual compensation paid for climate damages. But we also know that the causal chain between, on the one hand, a court case, and on the other hand, certain emission reductions or certain resilience build is, of course, a very long one, and it's a very difficult to show. But we also have intermediate impacts. And again, the report talked about this as well. We can think about impacts on public opinion, impacts on share prices of companies. We can think about also maybe impacts in terms of future cases, jurisprudential developments. Again, there's a variety of impacts, and some of them will be easier to measure than others. And some of them will actually be able to quantify it, and others we won't be. But I think it's also important to realize here the limitations of what we, as lawyers, can do. And I think here I just want to give a shout out to some of the work that Joanna has been doing, working with economists, also within the Grantham Institute, looking at the impacts of litigation on share prices. And I think it's that type of interdisciplinary work that we need much more. We need to look ultimately at what companies are doing, how they are reacting. We need to see what the impacts are on public opinion, for example, and try to link that back to particular cases. And ultimately, we asked, like, can I relink that to a particular case? Well, we have here, for example, last week, the UK Supreme Court decision in the Finch case. For me, it would be very interesting to trace that also in the coming weeks, months, years, what that actually means in terms of fossil fuel development in the UK. Does it actually lead to further fossil fuel projects being halted? Does it actually lead to measurable or significant change, for example, in a new UK government that might be elected next week? So it's these types of projects that I think require much, much heavier scrutiny to actually come up with a firm statement about what litigation actually means in practice.
I hope that there are many researchers, economists and lawyers in the room that have taken ideas about further fields to investigate. It's Cynthia, the last question for you. You're based in the US, and Joanna and Kate mentioned that initially the cases started to appear and increase their preponderance in the US. What type of impacts have you seen there regionally, and is there a different perspective that you can bring to the panel based on the different zone in which you operate, also from a regulatory perspective?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Sure. You know, I work in particular in financial regulation and climate risk, so I think maybe it makes sense to talk a little bit about the corporate climate disclosure laws that we've seen in so many jurisdictions as those regulations are coming online throughout the world, and in particular in the US. And this is a tricky question that you raise in this context, particularly for the US, because the Securities Exchange Commission, our SEC's mandate is to protect investors, right? There's no environmental mandate underpinning the SEC's climate disclosure requirements. They are purely about making sure companies disclose the financial risks that they're facing in connection with the impacts of climate change. So you see these disclosure rules designed with investor protection goals in mind. Maybe information disclosure itself has some secondary impact on climate outcomes. That's something we're studying, but there's limited literature out there on the behavioral impact of disclosure requirements. And I think what literature there is, the conclusions are mixed. It's not to say that there aren't other uses for this data, right? Information is non-rivalrous, right? The broader market, consumers and policymakers will certainly make use of it. But I think to your point, there is an enforcement angle that comes into view when you think about these disclosures becoming part of the sort of standard corporate disclosure regulatory regime, where in the US, so far at least, sustainability disclosures have largely been made on a voluntary basis with uneven results and very little accountability. And now, as the SEC's rule come online and climate disclosure requirements from the state of California as well that were passed last fall, I think you'll see companies are going to face the risk of liability attached to their statements in a different way. And that suggests enforcement actions and perhaps also private litigation coming into view as well to hold companies accountable. So I think that could be actually quite a significant impact going forward.
Great. Perhaps we can open the Q&A session. So what we're going to do is I'm going to take three questions and pass them on to the panel, and then we're going to turn to the online audience. So please start submitting your questions, and my colleague Emily will help us and read them aloud. So does anybody have any immediate reaction? Thank you. The gentleman there, and let's start with the gentleman there, and then I call out the other people. Please go ahead. Yes, thank you.
Hi. Oh, very loud. Hi there. Firstly, thank you guys so much for the panel and for this fantastic report. You guys do a great job every year, so really thank you for that. I'd like to maybe just tack on to what Cynthia was just saying there. So one of the trends that I'm really interested in is corporate climate litigation, considering, you know, the biggest 100 corporates are responsible for about 70% of global emissions. I think that's a trend that's only going to grow. But to Cynthia's point, I think it's mainly been quite voluntary in terms of what they're disclosing. There hasn't been that much accountability, but we're starting to see a bit more. For example, France's transposition of the CSRD is going to impose criminal actions against directors who fail to meet audit requirements. But I'm still maybe a bit skeptical, maybe a bit cynical about how that trend will actually continue moving forward. So I'd just be interested to hear what the panel's views are on the trends and in regards to kind of corporate penalties and potential remedies and how that might change going forward.
Great, thank you. Can we have another question, please? Maybe this person, sorry to make you run around the room. Perfect, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for the summary of the report. It's really, really interesting. I just wanted to pick up on what you were saying about last week's, I've been calling it the horse hill case, and you said about how we'll need to wait and see what happens when Labour comes in for future fossil fuel developments. Everyone's talking about 2024 as like the year of elections. There's so many elections going on around the world and have been going on. And I'm just interested to know what you think the impact will be on climate litigation action. Will there be more cases, less cases, different kinds of cases?
Great. Thank you. One last question. Yes, please. Thank you.
Hi, echoing everybody's thanks for the report. It's a nice follow-on from that question, actually, because it relates to politics. I mean, disputes, decisions are only so valuable in some contexts as the way they're enforced. And we're seeing increasingly arguments about judicial activism coming into the play, particularly with the Kleinaar-Signorinen case. I just wondered what you think will be the impact of those arguments on climate litigation and any other views on that topic. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So perhaps we can start one question on trends in corporate climate litigation, repercussions of electoral changes on policy and climate litigation. And the last question is also partly related to the first one, if I understood correctly, is the enactment of the penalties that may be attached to the litigation outcome. Who would you like to start first, Joanna and Kate?
I guess each one of us can choose whatever part of the questions and add to each other. That's the beauty of a panel. I think I want to speak on the on this last point about these decisions being criticized for being judicial activism and how countries, courts, and those bringing the cases will potentially have to deal with this. So the first point I would make is that it's not surprising that these decisions are political. They are telling governments they are not doing enough, they have to do more. So of course it's not an easy decision to swallow. And in a polarized, political, complex world, that will be used. Especially we've seen in Switzerland, and we can imagine this in the UK, where the issue of a European judge telling you what to do can be easily brought into many other agendas where you're trying to make that point. So I think, first of all, there is a real danger, and it's really problematic that decisions given by, for instance, the European Court of Human Rights are being disqualified, and you have policymakers saying, no, we're not going to take this because this is unlawful, and it discredits courts. So I think, to begin with, this is it's really bad and shouldn't be happening. But once it happens, I think the way I'm seeing this, it goes into this world of people saying absurd stuff and waiting to see what the reactions are. I don't imagine this will stop. Lawyers bringing cases, organizations bringing cases, and it shouldn't stop also the decisions being forced. It could lead to an ultimate horrible situation where those breaking, not following the decision will be punished for that, and you can imagine fines, and other jurisdictions will have different mechanisms. I would hope we are not getting there, and that it, there will be an understanding that there is a manipulation of these agendas in the benefit of those other interests at place. So I will stop here, and then whoever wants to continue, Zanita.
Zanita, you want to take that one? Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, so I just have one point to add. So, Sarah, what you said is the decisions are only as valuable as they are enforced. And I don't necessarily agree with this when it comes to impact, which I know other panelists have addressed. And there is one impact that I want to mention that nobody mentioned, so I'm like filling that gap, which is, we, as lawyers, we sometimes get stuck in the legal arguments, right? And, like, what is it, like, I know that I was interviewed after Klima Senior, and the journalist asked me, so, like, will this case have any impact beyond Switzerland, because it's only against Swiss government? And I remember I just responded, so tell me the difference between a Swiss human and a British human. Because apart from language and nationality, there's probably no difference, right? And when you, the point I'm trying to make is, when you take the case outside of law, outside of the nitty-gritty of jurisdictions and admissibility and all these things, and you look at the impact of on the humans. So Agostino, the children in the Agostino case, they lost their case on procedural grounds, right? But Klima Senior and Senior Women won. It's a victory for the kids as well, right? Because they are the same people as these elderly women. They are just a bit younger. But from the point of their human rights, they are nothing different from the Swiss human. So my point here being, there is a massive psychological impact that a successful case has on people like us, because we are saying, these kids are saying, climate change is impacting my health. And they see their government doing nothing. And that hurts, right? That's a point of, like, you are not hearing me. Like, this is really seriously impacting my life. And then all of a sudden you have a positive decision in a different case, but it is saying that government have to protect you against the impacts of climate change. And all of a sudden that your perception of reality, which is climate change is real and it's impacting the quality of my life, is validated by the court. And I think that's an impact beyond law. That's a psychological impact on these people. And that impact is magnified or multiplied by the ecosystem in which we live, and I mean the social ecosystem. So journalists picking up these cases, extremely important, because otherwise we are in echo chambers of lawyers talking about jurisdiction and admissibility and arguments that only we understand. Nobody else understands these arguments. So when you have a successful case or unsuccessful, and you have journalists taking it out into the public, explaining the case without the legalese, I think the impact could be beyond law. Impact could be impact that we can't even quantify or understand.
Yeah, this goes back to the point that Harold was making, that it's difficult to quantify exactly and measure impact, and also perhaps the point that we were making at the beginning of the panel, that even cases that don't quite go as they're supposed to go can have
exactly
ripple effects and consequences. Who would like to take the question on the election changes, the electoral changes? I guess the question is really the policy stability that you would need despite the changes in government.
Yeah. So how I see, or at least I would break my answer down into three parts, or at least three types of answers. One is the impacts of the elections on the number of cases. And here I would argue in those jurisdictions where we do see a shift to governments which take climate change less seriously. And unfortunately, that is the case for at least a number of countries where this might happen. Including some major countries, as we all know. And I would expect an increase in cases. Increase in cases at maybe at the subnational level, increase in cases against corporations. So I do think that this will affect the number of cases. Then the second implication might be in terms of the success rate of cases. And again, looking across the pond, where we increasingly also see the judiciary being politicized, again, that may have an impact on the positive outcomes of some of these cases. And then third might be the overall consequences and implications and to what extent, let's say, even if you have positive rulings, what might be the chances of these rulings having an impact on the ground in terms of emission reductions. And here, again, if we see the shift indeed to governments who care less about climate change, I think ultimately there also will be a higher chance of rulings just being ignored. And going back to maybe the Klima Senioren case, I think there's a very interesting development what we're seeing now in Switzerland, where there's all kinds of parliamentary debates, where some people or some parts in parliament are basically saying to ignore what the European Court of Human Rights is telling Switzerland to do. Doesn't mean that the government will ignore it altogether, but it gives already a bit of an indication of where some of these developments might be heading. Likewise, the advisory opinions that we see at the international level, if we get a Trump government in the United States, even if we get a very strong suggestion of what the climate obligations of states are at the international level from the International Court of Justice, I doubt that the US government under Trump would actually take that very seriously. And I think this is a broader issue, of course, because it's problematic, but it's a broader issue where we have some of governments not taking the rule of law more generally as seriously as one ought to do. But these are some of the ways in which I would predict, I would expect the elections to have an impact.
Yeah, Kate, sorry, I need to bring you in here because the CSRD was mentioned, and with all your expertise on how fast the regulation has changed in Europe, perhaps you can comment a little bit on the question on the corporate climate litigation trends and the penalties that could be associated with the enforcement level that we could expect from regulatory requirements that are coming up in Europe.
Absolutely. I'm happy to comment on that. And I think really there's actually two parts to this question. One is, how are we seeing regulation changing and how is that likely to affect the landscape of corporate climate cases? And this is what Cynthia has just been talking about. So far, cases have been based on the data that's available. They have been based on trying to interpret existing laws that are not necessarily specific to climate change and say they apply in a climate change context. What we're seeing is, at least in Europe, much more regulation that is specific to climate change. And that's going to change the shape of a lot of this litigation. We're going to see cases that are about enforcement, that are about compliance, that are based in data that we're going to have for every company, not just the companies that have said what they plan to do about climate change. So I think that's one way in which the landscape will change. But I think the question also mentioned this kind of question of penalties. And this is something that's also coming from another angle. We're seeing around Europe, again, in particular, discussions of climate change and the criminal law in ways that we haven't seen previously. So there's the concept of ecocide that's being developed at the international level primarily, relates to the idea that crimes against nature should be taken as equivalent with crimes against humanity. And I think that's one sort of area where we're seeing this shift. But we're also seeing people trying to use criminal arguments in domestic courts. And there was just an interesting case in France where a group of activists filed a request to a prosecutor in France to prosecute the CEO of Total for crimes including manslaughter related to deaths that occurred in climate-related disasters. Now, I'm not saying that I think that the French prosecutors are going to accept that suggestion and start prosecuting this, but I do think we're seeing a potential for worlds to collide, and we could see some really interesting questions about, you know, what actually are the penalties if you're seen as a company that's breaching the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive? How are countries going to start implementing and building on these points to really increase that level of accountability? Of course, that goes back to the political question, who do we have in government? Because it's parliamentarians that make the laws and governments that enforce them. But I think that's a really interesting kind of area for development.
Yeah, and this goes back to the point that Cynthia was making earlier. In the US, it's been so far more voluntary, at least it's happening on the voluntary basis, where here in Europe it's becoming more mandatory and we have to see the consequences of it. Cynthia, do you want to add anything at this point? Or we can go to the online questions. I just don't want you to be feel left out because you're online.
The report covered the sort of new version of Superfund cases, which are the sort of polluter pays laws that have just started to get traction in the US. There one was passed in the state of Vermont this spring. There's another one pending in New York and several other states. And those are maybe a new front in corporate climate accountability. So far, the litigation that we were talking about is more consumer protection. There is also the securities bucket of using corporate disclosure requirements to then hold companies accountable, although maybe it's worth talking about the litigation challenging both the SEC rules and the rules out of California, because those are sort of equivalents to the CSRD, but facing significant court challenge as well under the sort of anti-climate aligned cases.
Great, thank you. So let's see if we have any questions online. Emily, thank you.
Thank you very much. We do have quite a few questions, but I'll just take three.
Maybe we'll take three.
Yes, yeah. Perfect. So the first question is from Richard Harvey at Greenpeace International, their legal unit. And he's wondering if the panelists could elucidate on or respond to, in light of the UKSC decision in Finch versus the Surrey County Council, what prospects and problems do you see for the Scope 3 emissions issues case now being taken up by the ECTHR in the People versus the Arctic Oil case? The next question comes from Antje Kunst. And they are wondering, do you think that case law from the ECTHR, like the Klima Signorina and Agostinho Duarte, also taking into account the ECTHR's position on extraterritoriality, do you think that this is more powerful than case law resulting from climate litigation before domestic courts, or that it might have the potential to be? And finally, we have a question from Richard Delavan. And he is wondering, what does the panel think of developments around the introduction of climate superfunds that seek to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for the damages their activities have caused, such as Vermont's Climate Superfund Act, as a complement to strategic climate litigation? And do you think it's possible that other jurisdictions outside the U.S. will follow suit and introduce similar superfunds?
Great, thank you. Cynthia, could you hear the questions online? Okay, I wonder if the one related to the superfunds is one that you would like to address, the last one that we've heard about?
Yeah, I think the question puts it very well, that these regulations could be a very nice complement to corporate climate accountability cases that exist so far, because the litigations thus far have followed the model of sort of tobacco suits, right, around consumer protection laws where the public has been misled about the harms of fossil fuels as a product, right? And so there is a different set of proofs, like just from a legal standpoint in court, that you need to establish. These Superfund laws take a different path and set up accounts that are dependent on attribution science more than anything else, to think about fossil fuel companies' contributions to sort of the cleanup of climate change harms. And so I think they can work in tandem very effectively.
Thank you. So yes, please, Harold, go ahead.
Just to complement the response there, and I think to also add a note of caution. So this is, of course, in a way, like a manner of holding corporations to account for the climate harms that they cause. But the climate harms that are being experienced are not most of all experienced in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. And I think one risk that you have with pursuing this based in the United States is that you kind of miss out on all of these other damages that would be pursued. So in a way, what would be important in developing that, given that the harms are taking place outside of the territories of the United States, is trying to find a way in which also some of this funding and some of the compensation can go to other jurisdictions as well.
Yeah.
And of course, that will be tricky.
Big challenge.
That will be difficult. but I think if that component is ignored altogether, then you might get quite a nice settlement in the United States, which actually doesn't really address the climate harms that are being experienced.
Yeah, yeah. And this goes to the point that Janita was making earlier about the difference between the local biodiversity issues versus the global climate issue problem. Yes, Kate.
Maybe just also to come in on that point and to say we are seeing legislation like this being developed in other countries as well. The Philippines has a law that's currently being debated in their parliament, which is also looking at this question of holding corporations accountable. Now, it will be much harder to enforce this kind of legislation in the Philippines than it is in the US, where you have large numbers of fossil fuel companies headquartered. But I think that's a really important development not to neglect. And what you could see as a future pathway for this is some kind of incorporation of this issue into discussions at the international level, thinking about what does a global settlement actually look like? How would we do that? That's not something that's ever been done before. We have, of course, precedents of settlement agreements that are very wide-ranging, but they're all within national legal systems. And this issue really requires us to think a little bit outside of that box. So I think that's an important one.
Very quickly, if I would like some comments on the first question on scope 3 emissions, which actually resonates a lot with the work that we do at the TPI Center, because we do assess companies, and depending on the sector in which they operate, the issue of the scope 3 emission calculation and disclosure is an important one. And when it comes to the supply chains, it's even more difficult to address. Any thought on that?
I would love to answer that question, although I'm conscious that I have just spoken. But Richard referred to a case, People and Arctic Oil, which is another one of these climate cases that has been going on for many, many years. And for those who don't know what the case is about, it was filed in Norway, and it was questioning whether or not the Norwegian government's decision to grant new licenses for oil and gas exploration, so a very, very early stage of the oil and gas development process, whether those licenses might breach the right to a healthy environment if the impacts of climate change and scope 3 emissions from oil that would eventually be developed weren't taken into account. And in the Norwegian courts, essentially one of the arguments that was successful was that this was way too early in the process to actually start thinking about climate impacts and climate harms, and the granting of these initial licenses wouldn't necessarily lead to the actual development and extraction of the oil and gas, and that wouldn't necessarily lead to the burning of the oil and gas in the end. Now, we recently had a decision from the UK Supreme Court in the case of Finch, which essentially holds that you can see, if you're talking about a new oil and gas development, which is more at the production stage, that that is going to lead to greenhouse gas emissions when the oil extracted is burnt. And so we could see that kind of argument that says, actually, there is a clear attribution between this development and the ultimate goal of the product, which is burning the fossil fuels, appearing at the European Court of Human Rights. Could be an interesting development, as Richard probably knows better than anyone.
One to watch. Harold, perhaps I can turn to you for the question on extraterritoriality.
No, actually, I just was going to compliment, compliment again, Kate. So I think it's a very important development, right? Like what we see in the UK Supreme Court, but also what we saw a few months ago with the Oslo District Court already indicating that basically a common fact that once fossil fuels are extracted, they are most of all burnt. Right? Like, so that is a very basic causal chain, and it was very good to see the UK Supreme Court actually acknowledging that. One of the challenges will remain, and that's something that we will see, is that one of the common defenses and one of the common counter-arguments is that, well, yes, they will be burnt ultimately, but if you stop this project, then another project will come in and will replace them on the market as well. And here I think the jurisprudence in multiple jurisdictions is actually not equivocal, right? Like, so we have maybe a number of countries and a number of rulings saying indeed that that if one project is stopped, then maybe to some extent another project will come in and still provide and supply the fossil fuels. But we also see a number of rulings where actually that argument is being questioned. And I think that will be ultimately also a question of economics, a question of simply seeing how oil and gas markets work, how coal markets work. And there are studies that have already provided an indication that no, there is no such thing as perfect substitution, where, let's say, all of the oil and gas will be supplied by someone else. But we need to look at more specifically what extent we can actually see the supply being covered by other producers. And again, it will not be perfect, but to some extent it might happen. But ultimately, I think there are very factual questions, and I'm happy that we now actually can talk about these factual questions rather than avoiding them in the first place.
Very good. We still have to address very quickly the last question on extraterritoriality. I don't know who would like on the panel to address that. Perhaps Joanna?
There was this question whether the European Court of Human Rights would be more powerful than domestic litigation. And to an extent, it is, of course, very powerful because it applies not only immediately to Switzerland but to the 46 other members of the European Convention on Human Rights. So that in itself has an impact that is immediately quite broad, particularly as the decision in the Klimasonin was very prescriptive in terms of saying what is expected that governments will do. So it sets kind of a step-by-step almost in terms of you have to have this regulation and this regulation has to consider your reduction, how you're monitoring, how you're communicating. So it's very clear in that many countries will have to adapt, update, improve their existing regulation. So that means that gives a lot of power to the decision in the first place. But then, of course, there's the power of many other non-members of the European Convention that will look at the decision and take it into consideration. And we saw how immediately the decision was given in April, and the week after we were having the hearings in the Inter-American Court, and the judges were asking about what about this decision. So you can see it will influence the international processes, it will influence other domestic. But finally, I think that the domestic litigation, the one-by-one, the case-by-case, the Finch case, is very powerful. You know exactly what to do with that decision, whereas with the European decision, it's like, yeah, we have to do a lot of stuff now. Where do we start? And then you start having all those reactions. Whereas with a decision such as Finch, it's very straightforward. You know, now you have the need to report your emissions in your environmental impact assessment. So how do you measure which one is more powerful? I think they have different powers. Each one has a different power, and it's the added value of those powers that make this story so fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's been fascinating for me to learn from the report how diverse the whole field is and how much it's growing. I don't think we have more time to take more questions, unfortunately, so we need to have to draw to a close to the panel. I really do encourage you to take a look at the report, which will be available from tomorrow on online.
Today, it's already out.
From today, it's on the GRI website. Please join me in thanking the panel, Joanna and Kate, the authors of the report. Thank you, of course, also to Haro, Janeta, and Cynthia online. Despite the technical glitches, we've managed to have a conversation. Thank you to all of you for being with us tonight, and also to Emily for her help, and all the GRI events team that has helped us to put this event together. So all I have to say is to invite you to the drinks that will be hosted at the Pear Tree Cafe in Lincoln's Inn, and there are stewards that will give you directions. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.